Hello and welcome to the Bowles Rice Higher Education WV Educast. My name is Chelsea Brown and I'm a partner here at Bowles Rice who works with higher education institutions in various settings. In the work that I do with these clients, I see the many challenges and opportunities facing institutions of higher education. That's why we've decided to create this podcast where we can discuss these issues from changes in the legal landscape to social innovations affecting students, educators, and institutions alike. If there's one thing that is true in higher education, it is that change is constant. And part of our goal with this podcast is to bring you cutting-edge information that will assist with navigating those changes. On today's episode, we are focusing on the topic of Title IX in higher education. Title IX was enacted on June 23, 1972, to protect students from discrimination based on their sex in education or education-related activities. Title IX applies to all schools that receive federal financial assistance. Since its enactment in 1972, the scope and application of Title IX has changed dramatically, presenting both challenges and opportunities for higher education institutions in implementing the policy behind the Act. This year, we will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the enactment of Title IX, and it's the perfect opportunity to discuss how it has changed over the years and its effect on students in higher education. Joining me today is Kayla Cook, a partner with Bowles Rice, who specializes in the interpretation and implementation of Title IX in both K-12 and higher education settings. Kayla has worked with a variety of clients in the interpretation of Title IX requirements and policy drafting, in addition to serving as an investigator for Title IX complaints and as a Title IX hearing adjudicator and decision maker. Kayla's Title IX practice is a complement to her broader education and labor and employment practice, which has included workplace investigations involving harassment, sexual harassment, and discrimination. Welcome, Kayla, and thank you so very much for joining us to talk about changes in the Title IX landscape.
Hi, Chelsea. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Can you give us a little bit of background as to what Title IX is and what it is intended to do?
So Title IX is a federal civil rights law in the United States, and it was passed as part of the Education Amendment of 1972. What it does is it prohibits sex-based discrimination in any school or other educational program that receives funding from the federal government. And up until recently, most people just associated Title IX in regards to athletics, such as making sure there's equal opportunities for male and female athletes. And while Title IX certainly does still apply to athletics, its scope has now expanded to include sex-based discrimination, which encompasses sexual harassment and discrimination on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity.
So who does Title IX specifically apply to?
So Chelsea, you can think of it as like a contract between the government and the recipient of federal funds, such as a school district or university, and that is conditioned upon the recipient promising not to discriminate. So if this recipient receives federal funds from the government, they can receive those federal funds as long as they're promising not to discriminate against their employees or their students. But really, who is a recipient? Sometimes that's an issue that comes up. And a lot of people tend to get the idea that Title IX only applies to public schools or universities and that it does not apply to private institutions, but that is not correct. The term recipient literally means any state or political subdivision or any instrumentality of a state or political subdivision thereof, or any public or private agency, institution, or organization, or other entity or any person to whom federal financial assistance is extended directly, or the big kicker is through another recipient and that operates as an education program or activity. So a recipient can receive federal assistance either directly from the federal government or indirectly through a third party. And so that third party might not necessarily be a different recipient. So as an example, a lot of schools are indirect recipients when they receive payments from students who receive federal financial aid, even if it's a private institution. One thing to note, especially recently, is that due to the coronavirus pandemic, there are a lot more schools who are now considered recipients, even if they had previously not received any federal funding in the past. A lot of schools recently received funding from the CARES Act and through the Paycheck Protection Program. We also call it the PPP loan. So if an institution received assistance through the CARES Act or through a PPP loan, then that means that they too would be considered a recipient and be required to comply with Title IX until they've actually paid off their loan or their loan is forgiven.
So with the coronavirus pandemic, the scope and application of Title IX has actually gotten much more expansive then.
That's correct. Yes, there's a lot of schools who previously maybe hadn't received federal financial assistance from the government, but then they did receive the PPP loan or funding through the CARES Act, which now made them required to comply with Title IX.
So in 2020, we know that the Department of Education issued new Title IX regulations. What changes did they make in Title IX application, and what were these new regulations designed to accomplish?
So the new Title IX regulations became effective on August 14th, 2020, and they had a huge impact on how elementary, secondary, and post-secondary schools responded to allegations of sexual harassment consistent with Title IX's prohibition of sex discrimination by requiring those institutions to address sexual harassment as a form of sex-based discrimination. So although there had been those Dear Colleague letters up until 2020, there really had been no binding federal regulations related to sexual harassment under Title IX. So what these new regulations did was finally become law and change the way that schools define sexual harassment, the way they respond to allegations of sexual harassment, and the way they investigated and resolved complaints. The objective of these new regulations was really to make sure that each party was treated fairly and equally, and that there was now a streamlined process for how Title IX allegations would be investigated and resolved with a predictable and fair process that provided due process to all.
What were the most significant changes with the 2020 regulation?
The first big change was that we received new definitions. So, for example, the complainant is not now the person who just files the complaint, but the complainant is actually the alleged victim. So if someone files a complaint on behalf of somebody else, they're not technically considered the complainant. It's the actual alleged victim that would be considered the complainant. Another is actual knowledge. And actual knowledge is now when a school first becomes aware of an alleged incident. And for elementary and secondary schools, actual knowledge is triggered when any employee is aware of an incident of alleged sexual harassment. And most notably, for the first time ever, we now actually have an official definition of what constitutes sexual harassment under Title IX.
So under the 2020 changes, how have they defined sexual harassment under Title IX?
So sexual harassment is now defined as conduct on the basis of sex that satisfies one or more of the following. And there's three different subsections. The first is that an employee of the recipient conditioning the provision of an aid, benefit, or service of the recipient on an individual's participation in unwelcome sexual contact. So putting that in layman's terms, that really means like quid pro quo, I'm going to give you an A in return for you doing this sort of sexual favor. That's really what that first subpart means. Subpart two is unwelcome conduct determined by a reasonable person to be so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it effectively denies a person equal access to an educational program or activity. And then the third is just sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, or stalking as defined in the Clery Act or the Violence Against Women's Act. So with sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, you really only need one incident for it to trigger Title IX. Whereas that subpart two, that unwelcome conduct, that severe, pervasive, or objectively offensive, it can be different. You can have a lot of minor incidents that adds up to being severely pervasive and objectively offensive, or you can have one specific incident that is so severe or so offensive that it would trigger Title IX.
In addition to defining some of the terms under the statute, were there other changes to the regulations in terms of roles or processes?
Yes, the new regulations limited the obligation of a recipient to investigate only that conduct that occurred in the United States and in the school's program or activity. So previously, a school would be responsible for investigating something if it happened outside of the United States, maybe while during study abroad. That's typically the time when you would see that. And now the regulations limit that obligation to only investigate incidents that occur in the United States and in a school's program or activity. Another change is that there's new delineated roles for the Title IX coordinator, the investigator, and the decision maker. And it requires each to have certain trainings and certain functions. So now, under these new regulations, the Title IX coordinator can't be the same person who serves as the investigator or who serves as the decision maker. And likewise, the investigator can't be the decision maker either. And so a lot of times we have smaller colleges who have the Title IX coordinator, and then there's a Title IX investigator. And then those reports often get returned back to the Title IX coordinator, who makes the ultimate decision of whether or not there is a violation of Title IX. Now, with these new regulations, it really forces colleges and higher institutions to have a totally separate role, which is this new decision maker, especially as we'll get into here in a little bit, talking about the new decision-making hearing process that's required for colleges and universities.
In addition to providing clarity regarding the definitions under the Act and roles of decision makers under the Act, were there changes to the process as to how the Act was implemented?
Yes. So these regulations laid out mandatory response obligations of schools, such as supportive measures. For example, once a school has actual knowledge, the Title IX coordinator must reach out to the complainant. And remember, the complainant is the alleged victim, and provide supportive measures. And these supportive measures are non-punitive, non-disciplinary, and they're really to be offered to both the complainant and the respondent, regardless of whether there is ever a formal complaint that's filed. And other obligations that are required with the Title IX coordinator is that they must provide the respondent. And the respondent, we didn't discuss this earlier, is actually someone who is alleged to have violated Title IX. But so the Title IX coordinator is required to provide the respondent with a notice of allegation that details all of the information known about the allegations so that they're sufficient to provide enough information to defend themselves. And previously, what Title IX coordinators would typically just have to do is say, you're accused of violating Title IX for sexual misconduct, sexual harassment, and that would really be all of the information that the respondent had. Now, the Title IX coordinator must give this notice of allegation that gives specifics. As much information as the Title IX coordinator knows must be given to the respondent, even names, regardless of whether the individual asked to be kept confidential.
What types of supportive measures are offered to the complainant and to the respondent?
The supportive measures are really different depending on the facts and circumstances of each case. So the supportive measures, again, they're always going to be non-punitive, non-disciplinary, but it could be things like changes in work or school schedules, leaves of absences, no contact directives, allowing extra time to complete an assignment or to turn something in. So extensions of deadlines. It really is. Oh, and also one of the big ones is offering of counseling. So it really just depends on what the complainant needs. Maybe something with the respondent, if it's allowing them access to school to finish a final or, you know, those sorts of measures. But it really just depends. But you must offer them even if there's no complaint filed. Even if the schools are unsure of whether or not this does constitute Title IX, it's always best to offer supportive measures.
In terms of the grievance procedure, did the 2020 regulations affect that at all?
Yes. So the new regulations provide a more detailed grievance procedure that alters the way a school processes in response to complaints. So like I mentioned earlier with the notice of allegation, there are other procedures that are required under these new regulations, such as providing written notice to any party, giving them information as to the day and time of any interview before it happens. So you no longer can just surprise somebody and show up and conduct an interview of a party, a complainant, a respondent, or a witness without giving them notice ahead of time. Also, the regulations now give the parties a minimum of 10 days to review and respond to all of the information gathered during the course of the investigation. Sometimes we like to call these like a report of evidence. And then they have, after they review and respond to the report of evidence, they will then get a copy of the investigation report and receive an additional 10 days to review and respond to that final investigation report. So some people wonder, well, what is the difference between that first review period and that second review period? The first review period is a review of all of the evidence obtained during a course of the investigation, regardless of whether the Title IX investigator feels that it's relevant or not. If it's somehow related to the allegations, then it needs to be turned over as part of the report of evidence. And so what this does is give both parties equal access to see what the information is that's currently been gathered and give them the opportunity to add or correct any inaccuracies. So if there was something that was incorrectly stated in an interview or summary, they would now give the complainant or respondent the opportunity to clarify maybe what was said or correct something. Or if there's information that's missing that might be helpful, the party can then submit it. The second part is then after that first 10-day review of the report of evidence, then the responses get submitted, if there are any responses during that 10-day period, to the investigator. And then that investigator will then look at all of the information in the report of evidence, everything that they've learned during that course of the investigation, and then draft their investigation report based on what the investigator feels is the relevant information. So maybe a complainant or respondent felt something was relevant that the investigator didn't. The investigator's report of evidence is really just a summary of what they feel is relevant. And then the parties receive a copy of that to review and respond to. Also, the new regulations require a decision maker to make a determination as to whether the Title IX violation occurred. So I kind of hinted towards this earlier in our discussion, but this is entirely new. So with post-secondary institutions, a decision maker presides over a hearing where evidence is introduced and the parties have the ability to cross-examine each other through their respective advisors. The parties don't get to directly ask people questions, but the schools must provide an advisor for each party, and that's how the cross-examination occurs. Now, for elementary and secondary schools, the school can decide whether to have a decision maker preside over a hearing, or a decision maker can just facilitate cross-examination through the exchange of written questions. But again, this is a really, really big change, especially for higher ed, because now you essentially have to have this hearing with an actual trained decision maker to preside over this process. And again, the primary objective is really just to ensure that all parties have due process and have the ability to present their case.
In terms of the advisors that are provided, are those counsel or are those a different type of entity or representative for each of the parties?
So the regulations state that the advisor does not have to be an attorney. So while they could be, for example, a complainant is welcome to be represented by his or her own attorney, same with as the respondent, but they don't have to be. So it could be an advisor at the school. It could be a friend, a coworker. It could be whoever the individual wants, but they do have a right to have an advisor. So if the respondent requests an advisor, the school must provide one. But yes, it does not have to be an attorney.
Now that the regulations have been in effect for over a year, what do you see as the greatest challenges for higher education institutions in complying and implementing these new regulations?
I think one of the greatest challenges right now is that we are all still very much in the throes of this pandemic, and everyone working in education is and really has been working overtime, making sure that schools are safe for their students, doing contact tracing, while also being understaffed and at the same time now having to wrap their heads around these new Title IX policies and procedures. It's really just a lot. And in my experience, I see administrators being very intimidated by all of these new Title IX changes just because they are so different than how we've always been handling Title IX in the past. Another challenge kind of goes along with what I mentioned earlier about how the new Title IX regulations limit a school's obligation to investigate complaints that occurred during a school's program or activity. With all of these new virtual platforms that schools are using these days to connect, and we still have so many students participating remotely, it gets very, very tricky to determine what constitutes a school-sponsored program or activity and to determine when a school's obligations under Title IX are triggered.
Now, with the new regulations, have you seen an increase or a decrease in the Title IX filings?
Especially with regard to post-secondary institutions, I would say there was a decrease in Title IX filings before the regulations no longer obligated a school to investigate allegations that occurred off campus. A lot of times with higher ed previously, a lot of the instances occurred either off campus, at someone's own private apartment, at a bar, something like that. And so really now these new regulations meant that schools no longer had to investigate complaints that occurred in those private apartments or at bars or while they were on spring break as long as they occurred off campus. With elementary and secondary institutions, there was a brief pause initially, especially when everyone was remote. But now I feel as if our schools are being swamped dealing with Title IX. These new regulations really place a lot of responsibility on the Title IX coordinators to update policies, get trained, and offer supportive measures. And now the Title IX coordinator also has the choice of whether or not to decide to file a complaint on behalf of a complainant if that complainant chooses to not file a complaint for themselves. So I'd say regardless of whether it's elementary, secondary, or post-secondary, everyone working in Title IX is really busier than ever.
So what would happen if you have a situation where you have a complainant who really, really does not want to file a complaint, but the institution has knowledge of a situation? Are there any other options available?
So there are still some ways that a school can respond if they have actual knowledge that something may have happened. The issue is that a school cannot punish a respondent for violating Title IX without going through the full formal Title IX grievance process that we've been discussing today. Sometimes, though, if the allegations don't meet the definition of sexual harassment to constitute a violation of Title IX, so say maybe the incident was not severe, pervasive, or objectively offensive, or did not occur on school property, a school could essentially use a different policy to discipline an individual, or, you know, as a way to respond, such as the student code of conduct, if there's an employee code of conduct. But a school cannot punish or discipline a respondent for violating Title IX unless they go through this grievance procedure.
So Kayla, why would a Title IX coordinator file a complaint if the alleged victim doesn't want to?
So remember, Chelsea, the goal of Title IX is to ensure that all students and employees have a safe environment free from discrimination and sexual harassment. So even if a complainant chooses not to file a complaint, the Title IX coordinator can still do so. By continuing with the investigation and this grievance process, it sometimes can help identify additional victims who also need to receive supportive measures, or identify individuals who may have been aware of the discrimination and didn't act accordingly. So continuing with an investigation can make sure that not only is the complainant protected from future acts of discrimination, but it really prevents others from experiencing the same as well.
So Kayla, with the new regulations that came out in 2020 and the changes on the horizon, there are lots of challenges to higher education institutions in implementing those changes. What could happen if a school does not implement the regulations or act in accordance with Title IX?
So the ultimate penalty for non-compliance with Title IX regulations is actually the withdrawal of federal funds, including money that is earmarked for student loans. So obviously, with so much money at stake, colleges and universities across the country are really paying close attention to the Title IX regulations and making sure that they comply so that they don't lose any of those federal funds.
What changes do you see coming, either through the courts or through the Department of Education in the future?
Well, recently there's been a lot of changes coming through the courts. So in the summer of 2020, the Bostock versus Clayton County case, the Supreme Court held that Title VII's prohibition of discrimination in the workplace because of sex, and I'm doing air quotes so our listeners can tell I'm doing air quotes, because of sex includes discrimination because of sexual orientation and transgender status. A couple months later, two appellate courts cited that Bostock decision to support a holding that Title IX protects transgender students as well from discrimination on the basis of their gender identity. And that big case was really Grimm versus the Gloucester County School Board. The Supreme Court did not overturn that Grimm decision, holding that it was a violation of Title IX for that school to refuse to allow a student to use the restroom that corresponded with their gender identity. So really, Title IX then, based on that court's holding, does apply to the discrimination where it's based on gender identity. Federal courts have also caused changes to these 2020 regulations by finding that certain provisions are arbitrary and capricious. So one part of the regulations had previously held that if a party did not submit themselves to cross-examination and a live Title IX hearing, then any prior testimony that they offered could not be relied upon. In August of 2021, a federal district court entered an order vacating that portion of the rule, stating that it was unlawful. So in response, the Department of Education announced it was no longer going to enforce that position, thereby allowing decision makers to consider information provided by absent or non-cross-examined parties. But this still only applies to post-secondary schools. And so really what this does is it doesn't stall the process. So previously, the way the regulations were written, when you would get to a hearing for these, you know, post-secondary schools, we'd get to this Title IX decision-making hearing, every party has a right to be cross-examined. But if, say, the main complainant who provided all of the information was unable to attend that live hearing or refused to attend the live hearing, then we weren't able to use any of that information that that person had previously given to the investigator because they weren't making themselves available to be cross-examined. Now, with this new decision by the federal courts and the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education announcing that they were no longer going to enforce that provision, that means that even if someone doesn't show up to the hearing or make themselves available for cross-examination, you can still use information that they had previously given to an investigator. There's also been several lawsuits involving the rights of transgendered students that are on the horizon. So I do see a lot more changes coming. Also, most importantly, the Biden administration has put together a committee to rewrite the 2020 regulations and create some new rules related to a school's response. We believe, obviously, creating new protections for transgendered students, following in light with what these recent court holdings have held. And so this past December, it was actually announced that these new regulations were going to be unveiled sometime in April of this year. So there's definitely big changes still on the horizon.
Kayla, with all of the changes that have occurred in Title IX recently and the anticipated changes that are coming out in 2022, how do you, as an attorney, work with higher education institutions to help them be in compliance with Title IX?
So there's a couple of different ways that I can help. The first is really, you know, drafting the policies to make sure that they're in compliance with Title IX as these regulations change, or reviewing and auditing policies that are already in place just to make sure that they meet all of the requirements. Another thing that I do is I offer trainings to Title IX coordinators, investigators, and decision makers. These new regulations require that each of those roles have specific training before they're actually starting the investigation process or the grievance process. So making sure that schools have those individuals trained before a Title IX complaint comes in is very helpful. So doing that, that way everyone's ready to go once the complaint is filed. Another thing that I do is I can also serve as an investigator or a decision maker, which I've done in many instances. And so what this does is help alleviate the stress of maybe a smaller school that doesn't have the resources to have three individual roles for this Title IX grievance process, or to help when it's a high profile matter and you want to make sure that it's done properly. The regulations allow that a Title IX coordinator can outsource these roles to a trained third party. And so by me stepping in that role, either as the investigator to help do a thorough investigation, or maybe the trained investigators that you have are conflicted out, serving in that capacity or serving as that neutral decision maker really helps alleviate a lot of the stress of schools when they're deciding, you know, who are we going to have to fill these positions? And finally, you know, sometimes I'm just there to offer support or guidance as schools try to navigate Title IX and all of the changes being thrown at them.
Kayla, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the first episode of Bowles Rice's Higher Education Focused Podcast, WV Educast. I greatly appreciate you taking the time to answer these questions and share some of your experiences with Title IX in higher education. The information you have shared with me and our listeners today will be valuable as they navigate through the changing Title IX landscape.
I could help.
That's a wrap for this episode. Make sure you tune in and join us for our upcoming episodes of the WV Educast Higher Education Edition podcast. I'm looking forward to discussing more topics that are relevant to and affecting higher education. I'm Chelsea Brown, and thank you so much for listening.